From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1981 when a team of scientists published an article that served as a kind of warning. The planet was getting warmer, they wrote, and not simply due to natural fluctuations. In the past century, the 0.4 degrees Celsius rise had been consistent with the greenhouse effect, and the Earth would continue to get warmer as a result. It was not statistical noise. It was trackable, and it was about to get urgent. That article became front page news in the New York Times, and by 1988, a Senate committee asked one of the authors, James Hansen, to testify. His remarks serve as one of those hinge points in American history, a kind of awakening to a problem that maybe at the time few Americans were thinking about. Hansen served as the director of NASA's Goddard Institute and has become recognized as perhaps the single most influential scientist in bringing the awareness to climate change to the public attention here. And in 2005, the Bush White House asked NASA to kind of rein him in. Hansen pushed back publicly. He retired a few years ago, but is still teaching and writing books, even getting arrested in front of the White House as part of a public demonstration against the Keystone XL pipeline. Tonight, James Hansen will speak during an event at the Little Theater. Tomorrow, the local chapter of the Sierra Club will host him at MCC. Most of the nearly 600 seats are already taken. We're going to find out more about that in just a second. But later this month, he's going to even meet Pope Francis talking about climate change. But first, we're honored to have him as my guest on Connections. Dr. James Hansen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also in studio with us is Peter Debs, chair of the local chapter of the Sierra Club that brought Dr. Hansen here. And make sure we understand, are there any seats available tomorrow night at MCC, Peter?
Well, unfortunately, it is sold out. We had invited Dr. Hansen here because of our concern about the urgency of climate change and wanting to help educate our community and motivate our leaders to start preparing and mitigating it. And the result has been overwhelming. So if you do want to come, all we can say is you better plan to get there early, like around 6 o'clock, and we cannot guarantee a seat.
All right, so get there early around 6, and even then, no guarantee that there are seats available, but I guess cross the fingers, see what they can find out. That event tomorrow night. We'll talk more about that in just a moment here. And we're going to hear from a number of voices this hour on the climate change issue. Tim McGowan's here with the Citizens Climate Lobby. And so many other groups are so interested in Dr. Hansen's appearance here in Rochester this week. My understanding, Dr. Hansen, is you didn't really want to do this at first because you could speak anywhere you want in this country on this issue, but to some degree, you don't want to just preach to the choir, as you say. Is that fair?
Well, actually, I don't preach very often. I'm not a very good speaker, to tell you the truth, but I think I write better than I speak, and I'm writing what I think is an important paper, and then this summer I want to write a book, so it comes out before the Paris meetings. So that's why I don't normally accept speaking requests.
Okay, but I wanted to go back a little bit in history before we get into some proposals, possible solutions, dealing with just how urgent this issue is now. And for you, again, my understanding is that working for NASA, it was looking at Venus that made you, were you worried that in looking at Venus, you were concerned that perhaps you were looking at the future of our planet?
No, I was looking at Venus because, well, it was interesting to study other planets that were different, and I wanted to understand what the clouds were around Venus, and so I learned about light scattering, and it turned out that those clouds were sulfuric acid. Venus used to have an ocean and a reasonable temperature, but because it was close to the sun and because the carbon dioxide started, it got warm enough that the carbon dioxide all ended up in the atmosphere, and it got really hot. So
900 degrees hot, something like that?
Something like that, yeah, not quite that hot, but hot enough to melt lead on the surface. So I got more interested in our own planet because it's changing. It's a planet that's changing before our eyes, so it's more interesting scientifically and social, it has big impacts on people.
What was the time when you really knew that what you were looking at in terms of the numbers, the variation in temperature, was not, as you say, statistical noise? It was attributable to man-made activity. Do you recall when that was for you?
Yeah, that was the 1988 testimony. I said, It's time to stop waffling so much and admit that climate is changing, because it had the warming then was only about 4/10, or maybe it was approaching 5/10 of a degree Celsius then. But it fit in many different ways what we expected from increasing greenhouse gases. And now it's doubled. It's now 8/10 of a degree, and probably this year is going to be the warmest year in the history of instrumental measurements, and it'll be even a little higher, maybe 9/10 of a degree Celsius, which is about 1.6 or something Fahrenheit.
So that testimony in 1988 certainly had a profound impact on the conversation that has unfolded in the ensuing nearly three decades. But I'm curious to know how senators reacted, how government leaders reacted at the time.
Well, you know, a number of them agreed, but the problem is that the policies that they come up with are not effective. That's where we have the problem, and I'm really counting now on conservatives to come on board, because I think they recognize, I've spoken with a number of them, and they recognize if they pretend that this is a hoax, the public is going to realize that that's not the case, and it's going to demand a solution. So if conservatives want the solution to be one that's consistent with their way of dealing with things, a market-based solution, then they had better come on board pretty quickly.
When I've heard you speak on this and read some of your work, you use the terms market-based, innovation. Those are terms that I think that they certainly do embrace in general with a conservative ideology. And we're going to talk a little bit later this hour about some of the ways perhaps we'll see innovation away from carbon, away from fossil fuels. And so working for NASA, you're obviously working with governments and advising leaders. Did you expect that over time, starting in that 1988 testimony, moving forward, 27 years later, would you have been surprised that we are still sort of hearing drill, baby, drill and all of these different things in 2015?
Yeah, I am surprised. I probably shouldn't have be, but the other cases, you know, the ozone problem, chlorofluorocarbons, acid rain, when the science became reasonably clear, the government did take effective actions. This one is harder because the whole the energy industry is so powerful, and we depend on energy in so many different ways that it's much more difficult. It shouldn't be, because from the public standpoint, the solution actually makes sense and is not costly. But the public doesn't understand that, and their fossil fuel industry, most of it, would prefer to see business as usual continue.
Well, they've tried to convince the public, and we see this parroted in the work of the George Wills of the world, who write that moving drastically away from carbon could collapse the economy. That's the narrative that they've written.
Yeah, and that's completely wrong. You know, the truth is that if a market works better if the prices are honest. Right now, they're not. We're subsidizing fossil fuels, and we're not making them pay their cost to society. We let them use the atmosphere as a waste dump, and the public picks up the bill. If your child has asthma from air pollution, you pay the bill. The fossil fuel industry doesn't. And the climate impacts are completely going to be borne by the public, or the taxpayers, which is the public.
Talking to Dr. James Hansen, who is in Rochester for a couple of days here, for a couple of events, in fact. And I mentioned that in 2004, 2005, you were speaking a little more vociferously. And, of course, that was under George W. Bush's administration. NASA got a call from the Bush White House on that?
Yeah, that happened. They got two or three calls from the White House. And then NASA decided to assign a minder who would check my calendar, and I would have to get approval before I could give any talk. And if a media called me, I had to first report that to NASA headquarters, and they would decide whether I could speak to the media. And after I did that for a few weeks, and then after I had collected the data on what was going on, I informed the New York Times, and there was an article on the front page of New York Times, and then the restrictions got lifted.
The restrictions were lifted after you pushed back publicly. But now we've seen, a couple months ago, we saw in Florida reported that under Governor Rick Scott's administration, they have essentially told state employees, whether it's in reports, meeting dialogue, et cetera, you are not to use the terms climate change or global warming. Now, Governor Scott has denied that, but there has been extensive reporting documenting that that is the case there. Do you feel a parallel there?
Yeah, there is a parallel. But what bothers me is the fact that in our federal government, the things that I complained about have not been changed. Now, if a government scientist testifies to Congress, he has to first give his testimony to the White House. And that's true in Democratic administrations as well as Republicans. It doesn't make any sense. A government scientist is working for the taxpayers. He should be allowed to report on the science without having it censored first by the party that's in power. But the party that's in power also appoints political appointees to the public affairs offices of the science agencies. It doesn't make any sense. They feel that they have, in winning the election, that they are allowed to determine what the public gets to hear. It doesn't make sense in a democracy.
In looking then at our presidents that you have sort of, I guess, worked with in some capacity, from Reagan to Bush 41 to Clinton to Bush 43 to Mr. Obama, do you get the sense that that any of them feel the urgency that you want on this issue?
Well, I think that President Obama does realize that it's a real issue, and he actually, I think, wants to make it a legacy issue. So he would like to do something, but he missed the opportunity that he had at the beginning of his administration. If he had made this his first issue when the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, and if he had proposed an approach that would actually work, a market-based approach, he could have made a huge difference. Now it's very difficult. He's a lame duck, and the Republicans control the legislature, so it's difficult for him to do much. I still think he could do something in Paris, but he would have to, you know, get together with the Chinese and say, the Chinese, by the way, agree that this is a real problem. They don't deny the science at all, and they also realize that they're in line to suffer some of the worst effects of climate change. They're already seeing regional climate effects, but they have 350 million people living near sea level. They don't want the ice sheets to disintegrate. And so if Obama would agree with the Chinese leaders that, well, we're going to have an across-the-board carbon fee, those two countries could make it virtually global, because they could say, we're going to have a rising carbon fee, and we will impose border duties on products from countries that don't have an equivalent carbon fee or carbon tax, and that would force those other governments to either pay us, we collect the money at our border, or they decide to have their own fee and collect it themselves, and most of them would do the latter.
We're talking to Dr. James Hansen, and if you want to join the program, we're going to get to some of your phone calls coming up here. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. That's toll-free. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Tonight, Dr. Hansen will speak during an event at the Little Theater, and that event related to the film series, the Science on Screen film series at the Little Theater. Tonight, by the way, at the Little, might be your best chance to see him, depending on whether you can get into MCC tomorrow, because the local chapter of the Sierra Club is hosting the event tomorrow at MCC. But Peter Debs, again, if anybody wants to come out tomorrow, what do you tell them to do if they want to see Dr. Hansen?
Well, we're so happy to have had such an overwhelming response, but the result has been that we filled the auditorium at MCC. And we do have a small overflow area, but only a few people will be able to be in there. So you would have to come quite early, and you'd receive a number, and we would call people depending on what seats are available. I highly encourage people to get to the Little Theater tonight as an alternative.
That event tonight, 6:30, screening of the film Future Weather, and it will be followed by a discussion with Dr. Hansen and the film's writer-director, Jenny Deller. That starts tonight, 6:30. At the Little Theater, but I think Peter's advice is good tonight or tomorrow. Get there early and best chance to have a chance to hear from Dr. Hansen in person. Now, your sense of urgency on this issue, you retired officially from government work a couple years ago. You're teaching at Columbia. You're still writing. You're obviously traveling and talking about this issue. Everything I read says your sense of urgency really is sparked first and foremost by Sophie and Connor. Is that right?
Well, yeah, this is a intergenerational issue.
Your grandchildren.
Yeah, my grandchildren. We are doing things which our parents didn't, burning fossil fuels, putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which our parents did not realize would cause a problem for future generations. But we can only now pretend that we don't know. It's quite clear that there are going to be repercussions. And but the magnitude of those repercussions is still up in the air. It's still possible to limit the impacts, but I particularly worry about those things that are irreversible. One of the things that's irreversible is extermination of species. And if the climate change gets too large, it moves the climate zones, and many species will not be able to migrate at the rates that would be required. So that's one of the irreversible things. The other thing is sea level rise. If the ice sheets get to the point where they're really disintegrating, then it will be out of our control, and ice sheets do not grow back in less than tens of thousands of years. So we potentially could lose all coastal cities.
For our listeners who want to join the program, all the lines are now filled up. We are going to be getting the phone calls in the second half of the program, so hang in there because there's a lot of attention and demand to talk to Dr. Hansen, and we will be getting to your calls here. One of the common questions we hear from listeners on this subject is CO2, and let's head this off at the pass, Dr. Hansen. If we look at CO2, your analogy that I've heard you use, whether it's in your TED Talk or elsewhere, is putting an extra blanket on the bed, and there are some serious impacts here. But some people say, I thought CO2 could be a good thing. How would you explain the problem of CO2?
Well, CO2 is a good thing. I mean, the plants need CO2 to grow. The thing is that we're adapted to a climate and a given level of CO2, and if we continue to increase that level, it's going to cause various problems. For example, the last time the planet was 2 degrees Celsius warmer, sea level was 6 to 8 meters higher. That would mean all coastal cities are gone. So we can't arbitrarily increase the CO2 amount without causing big changes. And the planet did fine with sea level 6 or 8 meters higher. But humans have now established civilization on the assumption that things are going to be more or less the way they were the last several thousand years. But we have the potential to change the planet in huge ways.
Well, that's why when you talk about thousands of years, I cannot figure out how our species is going to really think long term. Because when you think long term, people like to say, well, in 25 years, you know, and if we want to preserve the planet for 100, how about 1,000, how about 5 or 10,000 years, let alone 100,000 or a million, which isn't that long in the grand scheme of the life of this planet. You have to change the mindset drastically, don't you?
Well, I think we don't need to worry too much about how it's going to be 100,000 years from now. We better worry about how it's going to be in the 21st century. And it is during the lives of people that we know and love. So we can cause large changes on decadal timescales. So it's not something that's just far off in the future. And it's something that we have to deal with now just because of the way the climate system works. It doesn't respond quickly. That's why this is so difficult. Normally, politicians and the public respond when they actually see the problem. Mm-hmm. And then when they did see problems like air pollution, like ozone, acid rain, then they waited until it became a problem, and then they solved it. This one, we can't wait that long.
I think that's well said. And so what to do about it? You've had ideas. We've talked a bit on this program about what's coming up in December in Paris. So first, before we talk about your issues with what may be coming up in Paris in December, set the stage for, remind our listeners what is coming up and what all the emphasis on Paris in December is all about.
Well, in 1992, was it, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, pretty quickly after the 1988 testimony,
yeah,
and the realization that there was an issue, the world did come together and agree, and the first Bush president agreed and signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change that we should avoid dangerous human-made climate change. And there was a treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, in 1997. However, it was very ineffectual. The emissions actually increased more rapidly after that agreement. That was a so-called cap-and-trade arrangement where countries agree that they will try to cap their emissions, you try to ameliorate the economic implications by allowing them some tricks on offsets, mm-hmm, and they'll say they'll plant some trees someplace. Well, that doesn't work.
No teeth in Kyoto.
No teeth in Kyoto. You actually have to make fossil fuel price include the cost that it imposes on society.
Well, that's a hard thing to calculate, and you've heard some argue that you could never really calculate it. It's certainly a non-zero cost, but how do you really calculate it, and what do you do about it? So your proposal, you look now, you say Kyoto didn't work. We actually had emissions increase. And now what do we do? Well, the world is looking at a new conference and a new meeting of the minds in December in Paris. And some of the proposals there seem to be rather strenuous, rather teeth-laden, so to speak. But you've expressed skepticism about what we've even heard proposed so far.
Yeah, well, they're still talking about cap and trade.
Okay.
And how can a cap work? What cap will India accept? You know, our emissions are 20 times greater than India's on a per capita basis. So they're going to say, well, you caused the problem and you got wealthy by burning fossil fuels. We're going to keep doing it. And they are. They're burning coal to beat the band. And so there's no way to beg 190 different countries to each have a cap. And the caps that they're talking about are not low enough to solve the problem. So what we actually have to do is get a rising carbon fee or carbon tax. And the only way the public will accept it is if the money goes to the public, not to politicians, not to the government, to make the government bigger. That's why it's really a conservative solution that we need.
All right, so let's walk through this. Your idea for a carbon fee, the money would go to the people, not the government, but how does it work?
You collect the money very easily because there's only a small number. You have to get it at the source so that it covers completely oil, gas, and coal. So at the domestic mines or the port of entry, you collect the money from the fossil fuel company. And then you just divide it equal amount to every legal resident of the country. That way, the person who does better than average, uses less than average fossil fuels, will make money. And there will be a big incentive to pay attention to how much fossil fuels you're using. And it will be more important, it will provide the incentive for entrepreneurs to develop alternative energies and low carbon and no carbon products. And we could move rapidly to a cleaner environment with rapidly declining CO2 emissions. For example, the proposed plan of $10 a ton of CO2 going up $10 each year after 10 years reduces U.S. emissions 30%. but it increases employment by 3 million people. It actually stimulates the economy. Because you're making the economy more honest, the prices are more honest, and you're stimulating clean energies and energy efficiency. So it doesn't depress the economy. You know, if you instead the government takes the money and uses it for social programs or whatever it wants to do, that depresses, then it becomes a tax, and new taxes depress the economy. So in that sense, the conservatives are right, in my opinion. We don't need new taxes. What we need is to move in the direction of clean energies. And the United States has a huge advantage. We have the best universities in the world. We can be leading this and developing products that we can sell to the rest of the world. But that will only happen if we have the incentive, the economic incentive of this rising carbon fee.
What have lawmakers, leaders of governments, said about your idea?
You know, for example, Barbara Boxer, a Democrat, loved the idea. And she said, we'll take 40% of the money to reduce the national debt. Well, that's the same as saying we're going to throw the money in the government's pot. There's no conservative who will accept that, because that is making the government bigger. You know, I've talked to conservatives, and they say, well, that's a good idea. We should have a revenue neutral. Those conservatives who realize that this is not a hoax, that climate change is real. So they are thinking about it, and they're saying, well, okay, we probably do need a carbon tax. Even ExxonMobil now says, yeah, there should be a carbon tax. But what the conservatives are saying, we'll reduce some other tax so that it becomes revenue neutral. They want to reduce taxes that conservatives don't like. Well, that the public is not, that really won't work, because if the public's getting the money, then they, and they know that this is exactly the amount that was taken, added to fossil fuel costs, then, and they can understand that simple system. But if you're just saying we're reducing some other tax that rich people don't like, and now gasoline is costing me more, they don't like that. And they're not going to allow it continue to get larger.
So what do we expect? Is there any hope that this idea, the carbon fee and dividend, could be part of any plan for Paris or elsewhere?
It needs to be demonstrated someplace. That's why I've been going around to, I've gone to about a dozen countries and a few states. We'd like somebody to demonstrate this.
A model.
Mm-hmm. And it's possible. You know, we now have, there's this organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, which understands this, and they have as their sole objective this fee and dividend idea. And they've doubled in size each year for the last few years. And so they're beginning to be large enough. And they're even expanding into other countries, Canada, India, about a dozen countries. So the movement is starting, but it's got to get large, because it's competing against the propaganda that the fossil fuel industry can put out.
Tim McGowan is here from the Citizens Climate Lobby. And let me ask Tim then, when you hear this proposal, is there enough, is it growing enough, and is there enough emphasis on it that enough pressure could be put on lawmakers to make this happen anywhere?
That's our intention, over the long term. What's happening now is that there has been some legislation proposed, both in the Senate and in the House, that are essentially discussional pieces of legislation. In both of these cases, they pertain to establishing a carbon fee, but the dividend is return to the American people is, in one instance, spread over 9 different programs by Senator Whitehouse's program. And Representative Van Hollen of Maryland has a proposal to also do a similar kind of carbon fee and dividend, but he uses primarily a cap-and-trade mechanism. So, long story short, there's some initial discussion. One thing that happened last March was that there were actually 40 senators that testified in the well of the Senate floor all night on March 10th about the need for climate change response. So many people don't know this, that there is awareness in the Senate, there's awareness in the House. Part of the problem is providing people and Republicans specifically with a with support, with political support, knowing that their constituents and constituents generally really want some action that is market-based to solve the climate crisis. And so we have yet to hear that articulated by Republicans.
All right, if you're on the phone, we will be coming to you in a moment here. We're talking to Dr. James Hansen, among others. Dr. Hansen is in Rochester today and tomorrow, tonight at the Little Theater for the screening of Future Weather at 6:30, and then followed by a discussion with Dr. Hansen and the film's writer-director. That's tonight, tomorrow night, out at MCC with a local chapter of the Sierra Club, talking about this intergenerational problem. And before I get to the phone calls, a few other points to hit here. On Paris, Dr. Hansen, we've heard the UN, among others, say 2 degrees Celsius is a concerning number, that we can't rise another 2 degrees Celsius. We've got to find a way to hit that number, kind of cut it off, use whatever mechanisms we can to prevent it. Is that grounded in science? What do you think about that?
No, it isn't. It was, in my opinion, it is not. It was considered to be realistic several years ago when it was proposed. I argue, and I'm working on a paper which will make it clear, that 2 degrees is actually very dangerous. The last time the planet was almost that warm, it was actually not quite that warm, was the Eemian 120,000 years ago, and sea level was at least 6 meters higher then. So what you would be saying with a 2 degree warming is, well, eventually, sea level is going to get 6 meters higher. We're not sure how fast it will happen. So it's not a good target. What we have to do is move as rapidly as we can to phase down carbon emissions.
Phase down carbon. Nuclear power?
Nuclear power, I believe, I'm actually researching that now because I want to have an objective discussion of that in my next book. But for China and India, I see no way for them to phase out their coal without using nuclear power. And they're eager. They have they're building nuclear power plants. But we should really be helping them to get the best technology possible because it needs to be safe. And there are tremendous potentials for doing the technology much better than the current technologies. So I think that is part of the solution.
I've talked to a scientist and a professor at Syracuse University who tells me climate change is very real. We have to get away from coal and oil, and at the very least, fracking is cleaner. It can be a bridge. No?
Well, gas has only about half as much carbon per unit energy, but there's too much potential gas. We cannot afford to put all the gas in the atmosphere as CO2. And so it is a bridge in the sense that if you have a rising carbon fee, coal will disappear pretty quickly and it'll be replaced by gas for some period of time. But we can't do that on the long run. But that will be taken care of naturally if we have a rising carbon fee.
And a couple of weeks ago on this program, we talked about your home state, Iowa, which is a bit of a presidential king and queen maker. And we talked not only about the pander fest that goes on in Iowa, but it relates to bad policy. Kent Gardner is an economist, the chief economist for the local Center for Governmental Research. And I want to listen to his comments saying that corn-based ethanol is not just a bad idea, but it's been preserved because of Iowa's power. And this is what Kent said about that.
The special subsidies that are provided through ethanol subsidies are particularly egregious. And just because there are other states that grow corn, it wouldn't happen if we didn't have the Iowa caucuses. Absolutely, single-handedly, that creates what has been probably one of the most damaging environmental policies of the last century.
Now, you're from Iowa. Agree?
Yeah, this corn-based ethanol is a bad idea. Yeah, I actually went to testify in Iowa at Marshalltown, where they were planning to build a coal plant to provide the energy to make ethanol. You know, a bad substance, and you're going to burn coal to make it. It's crazy. But that's politics. That's why we have to have a policy that makes sense, because, again, that a rising carbon fee would take care of the problem.
Last question before I turn it over to our callers for the rest of the hour, then. When it comes to innovation, you've used the term market-based, you've used the term innovation. Some conservative leaders have said just what you said, which is that when we hit a crisis, we innovate our way out of it. You said we can't wait till a crisis. But the other argument is, well, we could collapse the economy if we move too quickly. Do you believe that solar, for example, is growing enough? Are there other avenues that are growing enough that can employ tens of thousands of Americans in the short term if we move dramatically away from carbon?
If we put a rising fee on carbon, then the alternatives would get to compete, and we need all of them. We need solar and wind and, I think, nuclear power. But let the market make those decisions. You know, we have not only best universities and potential for innovation, but I argue that the captains of industry are not part of the problem. They can be part of the solution if we give them the right incentive. I've met with utility leaders, the biggest utilities in the eastern United States, and they say our first obligation is to the stockholders. So if fossil fuels are the cheapest energy, we have to use them. But if the government would give us the right incentives, we can help solve the problem. And they could. You don't get to be those positions without being a pretty smart and capable person. We just have to get the politics to give them the right incentives.
Let's take a very short break. Your phone calls for Dr. James Hansen are next right here on Connections. Thanks for waiting, Wiley. You're up first with Dr. James Hansen.
Hello there. I am so glad I got on here. I don't have so much of a question. This, you just said something now about, you know, letting the fox guard the hen house, of letting the higher ups, all the kings and emperors of the oil and power and energy kingdom up there, make these decisions when they see it's going to benefit themselves. And you were talking about the healthcare industry, but this applies the same way. And what I was thinking while I was listening is not so much of a question, but what do we have to do to get your idea out there as often as Rash Limbo and all these other clowns on the radio every day? Get you on there as somebody with the same point of view every day.
All right, Wiley, thank you very much for the call. We try to stay away from name calling. I don't think that was the radio host's real name, though I don't listen, so I don't know. But Dr. Hansen, he wants to know, how do we get this kind of idea out there more prominently?
It's going to require citizen involvement, because you see, you can't turn on your television without seeing these advertisements for how now the fossil fuel industry is making the United States energy independent. Well, we need to be energy independent, but we need to have clean energies. And so the fossil fuel industry can afford to not only have these advertisements there every day, but also encourage the radio show hosts and whoever who support their perspective. We still live in a democracy, though. And we can make it work. that's what Citizens Climate Lobby is trying to do, and they need support. It's a volunteer organization. It doesn't have the fossil fuel money behind it. It requires citizens to get involved.
All right. Well, how do people get involved with Citizens Climate Lobby or Sierra? Tim?
People can go to the website, which is simply citizensclimatelobby.org.
Okay.
To become familiar with the carbon fee and dividend and other information, our local chapter, et cetera.
Peter, Sierra Club?
Sierra Club has a website. If people go to Rochester Regional Group of Sierra Club on the computer, to take you right to our website, you can join there. You can also, and I would also like to say, we're just getting some new information in that there is a possibility that MCC will have a larger overflow room available so that people
tomorrow
who
night, yep,
do not have tickets already may still be able to see at least a live stream of it. So you can check again for sure by visiting our website, Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club, and we will post a message on there if that becomes available.
All right, back to the phones we go. Frank in Rochester. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, Dr. Hansen, can you talk about the documentary Merchants of Doubt that is now playing in the Rochester region at the Pittsford Plaza Theater, where you are featured prominently as a reality check on climate change?
Merchants of Doubt.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that recently, and they actually had a clip of me testifying in 1988. I found it as documentaries go, it was really good. You know, it exposed some things that I had not even realized how had the smoking, the cigarette manufacturers, and how they had got Congress to, instead of blaming smoking for the fires that were caused when people would fall asleep and their cigarettes would start a fire, they got Congress to say, well, this is really because of the flammable material that people have in their couches. And it was complete nonsense. But it exposed a lot of things that were not known. And the way that both the tobacco industry worked and now the way the fossil fuel industry works to misinform the public and continue to make their money.
Or use ostensible science. The show Cosmos, the current incarnation of Cosmos, did a very good job on the history of lead and the way ostensible scientists testified to Congress to try to preserve the foothold that lead had. And that took years. So that's another interesting point there. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Dr. Hansen. Dr. Hansen, I got to tell you, I've been a skeptic of man-made climate change. Not climate change itself. I think it's there. But I got to say, I like your methodology of attacking the problem, to put it into the hands of the taxpayers, give them the incentives, et cetera. I think it's an excellent idea. But I am a skeptic. I think the sun, naturally occurring methane from volcanoes, just from the earth, is the problem, and I don't think man can really control climate change in the long run.
I applaud your
methodology, and if this is forced upon us, I have to say, I like your idea.
Well, John, what would it take to change your mind on that then?
I guess I'd have to see. There's still a lot of scientists out there and experts in the field that disagree with man-made climate change. I would like to hear from them, and I think their points, I think, are very valid, and they're not convinced.
So what it would take to change your mind is the small subset of ostensible scientists who disagree with this, they would have to change their minds before you change yours.
Well, I think that small subset is exaggerated in its smallness. I think it's much larger than that. Back in, there was a project going back, I think 2008, 2009, there were supposedly 31,000.
Yes, the Spice Girls were some of them.
That disagreed with man-made climate change.
John, you're right. There were 31,000 signatories to that, including the Spice Girls. It was not a very well-vetted list. They were not credentialed. Anybody with any scientific background, you could be an expert on pig farming.
Wait, let me give you two off the top. I know three meteorologists, that disagree with man-made climate change.
I know them too. They're very smart guys, but meteorology is not the study of long-term climate. Climate and weather are two different things.
We'll agree to disagree on that. I think that between the sun and some of the methane emissions that come naturally out of the earth, those are the culprits, and I think the sun is the major culprit.
All right, John, thank you for the call. Go ahead, Dr. Hanson.
I think one thing you might do is view this Merchants of Doubt film, because it's got several of those skeptic scientists, and you'll get to some realization of what is driving them. There are other factors, not only human-made CO2, that cause climate change, particularly on long timescales. But you might appreciate my next paper, which will deal with these long-term climate changes. And it turns out that CO2 has a big role in those also. It is natural variations of CO2. But in any case...
Okay. Well, he's also saying he appreciates your market-based approach, that in many ways, John is a conservative, a business owner, who says if we're going to do this, let the market decide, as opposed to what the government did 10 years ago, and the government decided that corn-based ethanol would be a big winner, and we saw how that went. Peter Debs?
Yeah, I think it's also important to emphasize that one of the reasons we could say the United States is the most overpopulated country in the world is because of the amount of resources we consume. And a hidden part of this whole debate that we're talking about depends, too, on consumption and our dependence on consuming those things the way we've structured our society, for instance, our transportation. So another big aspect of meeting the challenge of climate change will be in finding the ways that we can drastically reduce that consumption.
All right, let's try to move quickly through some more calls. Allison in Rochester. Go ahead, Allison.
Hi, Evan. I'm actually going to relate to what you asked about degrees Celsius, too. I recently saw a YouTube from a speaker at Evergreen College, and if I remember correctly, he said that we were at 2 degrees Celsius now, and that if we got up to 10, agriculture would not be possible. Am I wrong on that?
Well, 10 degrees would make agriculture
impossible right?
in a lot of parts of the planet. But we are at now, relative to pre-industrial, a few hundred years ago, the warming is still less than 1 degree Celsius. It's almost 1 degree Celsius.
Okay. So you're saying that even 2 degrees would be dangerous.
Yeah, even 2 degrees would be dangerous. We're already seeing effects at 8-tenths of a degree. And at 2 degrees, they would be much larger, and the ice sheets simply could not survive. And, a 5-meter sea level rise means all coastal cities become dysfunctional. The economic implications of that are incalculable. So we really can't go there, even though there's some disagreement about how long it will take those ice sheets to disintegrate. It's actually, in my opinion, going to be a lot shorter than what's been talked about.
Dwayne in Rochester. Go ahead, Dwayne.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to hear you speak, Dr. Hanson, and thank you for bringing you on, Evan.
Sure.
I noted that you were concerned about preaching to the choir. It sounds like you've got a little bit bigger spectrum than you hinted at in that remark. But let me bring a couple of concerns that I think that the climate change movement that I'm a part of needs to be concerned with.
And keep it moving, Dwayne. We're going to be short on time, so 30 seconds. Go ahead.
All right. What about farm animal production of CO2 and methane, agricultural in general contribution of CO2 and methane, excluding the fossil fuels and fertilizers that they use, just in the general method of farming and large animal dairying that we use now.
Yeah, Dwayne, thanks for the call. Cows and methane, especially. Dr. Hanson?
Yeah, well, methane is several times what it was pre-industrial, and it actually will be part of the solution, because we can actually, methane only stays in the atmosphere 10 years. It decays into CO2. So if we can reduce the sources of methane, we help rebalance the planet's energy imbalance. And that's what we have to do to solve the problem.
Should we eat fewer cows?
Eating less meat, if you want to do something personally that helps the planet, become more of a vegetarian, because it does put a heavy footprint on the planet. But agriculture and forestry are going to be part of the solution. We have to have better agricultural practices. For example, no-till or minimum-till plowing can keep more carbon in the soil. And we can reforest and get a lot of the carbon back out of the atmosphere. So those will become part of the solution.
I wish we had a second hour with you, Dr. Hansen, but the good news is Dr. Hansen remains in Rochester tonight and tomorrow night. Tonight, 6:30, Future Weather, screening at the Little Theater in Little Theater number 1. 6:30 tonight. It's going to be followed by a live discussion with Dr. Hansen and the film's writer-director. So that's tonight. Tomorrow night, out at MCC, the local chapter of the Sierra Club is hosting. And if you get there early or contact the Sierra Club, you might have a chance to at least get into that overflow room. Hundreds of people will be out there for that. Peter, Tim, thank you for being here and helping facilitate the discussion.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Hansen, once again, welcome to Rochester, and thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Short break, and we're talking about what is white privilege next hour on Connections.